The Napoleonic Era. Napoleon in Exile, 1815 to 1821. Napoleon's Autopsy. Now, there will be some material prior to the autopsy, and I will mention something also about the death masks. But the death masks I'm going to do separately, getting ready to do the funeral part, which will be next week. So I'll do some stuff with that. I would also like to point out that as badly as I have treated Dr. Antomarchi, because he was a quack, he, however, is not a quack when it comes to the autopsy, because that's what he did. He actually worked with one of the greatest anatomists of the era. So he does an excellent job with the autopsy. So I just thought I'd get that up front, so when I mention his name during that process, we don't automatically go backwards and say, he's a quack, so maybe he screwed this up. No, he didn't screw this up. Screw the autopsy up. So let's pick up where we left off with the death of Napoleon. The people who were waiting outside, awaiting the climax, and as the sun set, Grand Marshal bent his knees beside the still figure and kissed his hand. Afterwards came all the members of his suite, in seniority, the servants, the women, and the Bertrand children, who had been fetched from the cottage by their mother. Even the daughter of Saint Denis, who was only a year old, was carried to give her baby salute to the cold flesh. At midnight, in the stillness, now more noticeable by the absence of the usual household activity, Marchand, Saint-Denis, Perron, and Novarez attended to Napoleon's body and carried it from the deathbed to a second camp bed, which was put in place of the one that was taken away. The priest laid a crucifix on Napoleon's breast. Montholon observed that the emperor presented an appearance of youth. His mouth was faintly contracted on the one side and gave his face an expression of resignation. He didn't look more than 30. 2 days afterwards, when two death masks were taken, the retraction of the flesh made him look older. Now, the priest then states that he did not leave the body until it was buried, something that Napoleon had actually asked for. He remained at the chapel, which is basically there in the house, praying until the coffin was finally carried out. Most of the suite, exhausted, went to their rooms after Napoleon had died, but were awakened by a messenger who announced that Sir Hudson Lowe would visit Longwood at 6 o'clock. He arrived at 7 with his entire staff, the admiral, the general commanding the forces of the island, the commissioner of the King of France, Montchenu, several naval officers, doctors, and surgeons resident on the island, an impressive cavalcade clattering past the guardhouse, receiving and acknowledging salutes, brave in full regimental outfit, yet a dejected group. Lowe was conducted into what was termed the room of death. Bertrand and Montholon were already there. They bowed to him, and with a gesture motioned him to approach Napoleon. Montchenu was close behind, and Lowe asked, "Do you recognize him?" The French commissioner turned his head to look and said, "Yes, I recognize him. He was the greatest Lowe then commented, "He was the greatest enemy of England and of myself, but I forgive him, big of him." The remark, its significance and delivery of tone marked the man for what he was. He omitted from some feeling that superimposed itself on his usual rudeness to mention that Bathurst, nor did he call the dead man general any longer. History had taken over, bringing a new evaluation. A human being 4 times unanimously acclaimed by his people as sovereign, anointed and blessed. Now in death, no living power prevailed against his rightful place in history. The Lowes, the Montchenus, the Bathursts, and the Castlereaghs took their places in smaller voices, blending the background of sound that the chief actors would exit in triumph. Lowe watched Montchenu's expression and sensed the attitudes of all the men around him. They were paying homage to someone timelessly great. Lowe roused himself almost in self-defense and turned to the group of silent officers to issue orders about procedure, the funeral, the sentinels around Longwood House, the regiments lining the route to Geranium Vale, where he would be buried. There was a post-mortem to be done in the billiard room on the dining table. At 2 o'clock, Antomarchi began the autopsy in the presence of Bertrand, Montholon, 3 British officers, and 7 doctors, and the priest, and some of the emperor's valets. So needless to say, nobody could do anything to get souvenirs here. So the first reports on the dissection of the body ran as follows, quote, on the opening of the body, it was found to be very fat with extensive disease of the stomach. The ulcer which had penetrated the coats of the stomach from the pylorus was sufficiently large to allow the passage of the little finger. The stomach was a mass of cancerous disease with a fluid resembling coffee grounds. The convex surface of the left lobe of the liver adhered to the diaphragm, and the liver was perhaps a little larger than natural. With the exception of the adhesion occasioned by the disease of the stomach, no unhealthy appearance presented itself. End of quote. Dr. Short, in his notes to Lowe, said that the liver acted as kind of a cork to the perforation, that the stomach was perforated through and through. In the center of the small perforation, the aperture was closed by the adhesion of the left lobe of the liver. So the liver was actually kind of blocking the hole for drainage. Lowe did not feel authorized to give the heart to Count Montholon, but he directed that it should be placed in the coffin separate from Napoleon's body. He ordered Dr. Rutledge to remain on watch at night and all night. Dr. Rutledge left a memorandum of what occurred during his melancholy watch. Quote, the heart and stomach, which had been taken out of the body, was put in a pure silver vase by me, and I was directed by Sir Thomas Reed, according to the order of the governor, not to lose sight of both the body or the vase, to take care and not to admit of the cavities being opened for a second time for the purpose of the removal of any part of the body, and not allow the contents of the vase to be distributed or disturbed without an order from him to that effect. End of quote. Now, this is an interesting point because there is a weird little book entitled Napoleon's Glands, where they claim that in the process of the autopsy and afterwards, that somebody cut off Napoleon's penis. And then, oddly enough, this gristly piece of meat, as it was referred to, shows up in a Flaterman's catalog from Boston and in a whole series of material from the island of St. Helena for sale. Now, nobody ended up buying it, but the thought of somebody taking Napoleon's penis as a souvenir is a little bizarre. It certainly sold this book because the book was actually about all sorts of different famous people's body parts and where they are in different museums. Okay, it's called Napoleon's Glands. And but since we have records of all these people keeping an eye on it, I mean, you're not going to do it during the autopsy. And, you know, they've got to guard it at night. When the autopsy was over, Dr. Antomarchi wanted to examine the brain, remarking that the site of that organ should be of the highest interest. To this proposal, Bertrand and Montholon strongly objected. The professor sprayed the opening of the abdomen with an eau de cologne and sewed the incision. However, somehow eluding the watching eyes of the English, Antomarchi extracted two fragments of bone, one from a rib and a principal tendon, and these he gave to the priest. In later times, certain schools of thought maintained that the cause of death was not cancer. That evidence supposedly came from these fragments of the pitted intestine smuggled to London to Dr. O'Meara. They were given to the Royal College of Surgeons and became lost. It is understood they were destroyed during the bombings in World War II. Professor Sir Ashley Cooper and Sir James Paget thought they detected cancerous nodules in them, but examinations by others did not. So they had quite a bit of that stuff. And during the autopsy, Antomarchi also removed the liver and demonstrated, as if to a class of students, quote, you see, gentlemen, how this ulcerated part of the stomach has become adhered to the liver? What are we to infer? That the climate of St. Helena has intensified the gastric disorder and has thus brought about premature death. End of quote. Well, that's a hot political topic. A vote was actually taken, the English against the French opinion. The English opinion was, of course, no, it didn't. The French opinion was. At no cost must it be thought that the climate had been a factor in the emperor's demise. Dr. Short, the naval chief surgeon, was asked to draw up a report on Napoleon's death to be dispatched to Lord Bathurst. It was signed by Short, Burton, Mitchell, and Arnault. On receiving it, Lowe became incensed, and there was feverish agitation at Plantation House. Dr. Short in the report noted, quote, the liver was perhaps a little larger than usual, end of quote. Lowe asserted that this would support the argument that Napoleon died of an affliction of the liver due to the St. Helena climate. So he brought every pressure to bear upon the doctor to induce him to delete the offending words. Short objected, but afterwards succumbed. His patience was giving out, and his appreciation of Lowe's influence growing on the recollections of the treatment of others stood out against the governor's orders. Under instructions, he therefore made the correction, and a second report went to Bathurst. The original draft is extant, showing the phrase relating to the liver scratched out, and a note appended, quote, "The words obliterated were suppressed by the order of Sir Hudson Lowe, Thomas Short," end of quote. So we have finished with the autopsy. It has shown what it's supposed to do. We're in the moments of the preparation for the body and, of course, the death masks and the coffins and that sort of thing, which we're going to be dealing with a little bit later on. Now, I haven't mentioned the arsenic. I know you're saying, where's the arsenic part? I will get to it. Let me get him into the ground first. After that, then I'll talk about some of the things that took place, particularly the arsenic idea. Now, a lot of these books are relatively older before some of the new material has come out on the arsenic, and so I will be bringing some of that new stuff in when we get to that point. Now, the sources for this: Napoleon St. Helena by Martineau, Cachier de St. Helena by General Bertrand, Napoleon in Exile by O'Meara, Le Dernier Moment de Napoleon by Anthony Marchi, Memoirs of Louis Marchand, With Napoleon at St. Helena by Dr. Stokey, The St. Helena Story by Dame Mabel Brooks,